Yeah. Hello and welcome to the sixth episode of Emacs.L. In this episode, we have Charles Lowell. He'll be talking about JS and about sharing Emacs configs company-wide. So hello, Charles.
Hey, Daniel. How's it going? Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Yeah, good, good. Glad you can make it. All right, sweet. So let's get started. The first question is pretty much, how did you get into Emacs? How was that adventure like?
So this is actually, I actually haven't thought about my Emacs origin story for a while, but it started at the very first startup that I worked back when I was 18 years old. So dating myself, this is probably 1995. So a long, long time ago, although, you know, not so long in terms of Emacs time. We were in those days, it was a e-commerce, startup, and we would do our development by logging into a server that had a checkout of the CVS repository, and we would edit the code and then, and then go from there. And we had a senior developer on the project who, you know, had opinions about editors, and every one of us, all of us were using, you know, kind of a collection of, I think it was either Nano or Joe. There was like Joe's own editor, which was really popular at the time, which was kind of like a Nano clone. Nobody was using VI or Emacs. And so after kind of pair programming with us a number of times, this developer was like, no. And he actually encrypted all the other editors. He encrypted the executables for all the other editors on this server, so that we couldn't actually even open them. So the only ones that he didn't encrypt were VI and Emacs, because he considered those to be like actual editors. So we all just started using Emacs at that point. So that was kind of it, my very first experience. So I kind of learned the basic key bindings and navigation and editing, but not really any of the power features. And then at my second job was a big Java application, or was a big Java shop. And so I got into much more the heavier weight tools. So IntelliJ was something that we used. TogetherJ was another one. Visual Age for Java. What was it? There was another one, Eclipse. All right, the big one, like Eclipse. And so everybody was kind of big on those things, because it really is kind of magical, the type of insights that those tools were able to provide on your code. And so I migrated away from, I was actually using Emacs for doing Java code for a long time there, but I was looking at the things that the people were doing with these big tools that were kind of analyzing their Java code bases. And I was like, okay, I need to get into this, because it wasn't not as good of an editing experience. And so I worked with IntelliJ, I worked with Eclipse, but then once I moved away from Java and started getting back into more lightweight languages like Ruby and JavaScript, the tools became more lightweight. And so I was using things like TextMate, and there was one other tool. But then at some point, TextMate became kind of abandonware. And so the kind of options, and this was about 4 years ago, the options were move back to, you know, some of the a mainstream tool like Sublime, or move back to, you know, something like, I think Atom was really new at that point. But I was like, you know what? I used Emacs back in the day. I'm, you know, heard really, really great things about it. There were a couple of different podcasts, and I actually watched this one podcast that this guy, the guy, the Emacs Rocks guy, I watched a couple of his podcasts that he did back in like 2011, 2012. I was like, all right, I'm in. I'm going to do this. And so that was kind of my second entry into it. And I said that I was going to do it for a year and then move on to something else. But I never looked back once I got into it. And I really, you know, having kind of the perspective of, you know, 15 years of software development, it was a much better tool for me back than it was when I was 18.
Wow, so that's interesting. So there was a pretty big gap between the Emacs usage from the first time to
So I'm not like, you know, I'm not a guru or a wizard. I'm still delving and getting, you know, getting into it and trying to understand it. It's been fantastic, and it's exposed me to, you know, I learned Lisp, and as a result, you know, then learned Clojure because of you know, having such a good time working with Emacs Lisp. And so yeah, it's been great.
Nice. I'm still a little amazed. The whole that guy encrypted all the executables for the other. That's hardcore.
It was hardcore. It was harsh, but it was totally the right call, because we were wasting time with you know, amateur editors, things that didn't really have any power except to do kind of inline editing. And I mean, it's amazing that, you know, Emacs couldn't even do half the stuff then that it does now.
Yeah, I've heard that from talking from most folks that the Emacs, how much Emacs has grown within, you know, from the 90s to now is pretty huge. So,
yeah,
I mean, I'm thankful I never got this all, you know, from the 90s side. I'm thankful that I only started using it a couple of years ago. So,
yeah, it was pretty opaque back then. Right. I think it was still powerful as editors go, like the basic things like being able to record macros and being able to, you know, interactively call any Lisp function. You know, it was all there, but there's definitely been a renaissance, I would even say, in the last 10 years of people really starting to do amazing things as they're, you know, because before it was, I guess, yeah, Emacs was actually kind of on the out. There was like X Emacs was ascendant, and yeah, nobody really used GNU Emacs that much. So yeah.
Okay. All right. Right on. So since one of the reasons I reached out to you was because I saw that your company has a Emacs-wide config. So out of curiosity, how many people actually use Emacs within your company?
So we're actually a fairly small shop. Right now we have 4 developers. Although people who have used and been exposed to Emacs and the kind of shared configuration over the last 4 years is probably around 10. I would say, but even at 10 people, you start to reap the benefits of scale, and the benefits of having a shared configuration.
Okay, sweet, right on. Yeah, I think it's more feasible with you know, like a smaller company instead of trying to go enterprise with something huge like HP. You're not trying to convert
right. Right, yeah, right.
That would be nice. Yeah.
Right, no. But I think you can still, you know, within HP, in the same way that you can have little kind of startups within big companies, you can have little pockets of people who agree to do stuff that like that. Because I think I think the value that we derive from it is definitely derivable from a company like HP, in the sense that the reason that we use a shared configuration is because that way every single person is able to benefit from, one, the discoveries that other people make, but also the things that they bring in from the community. And I guess that's a form of discovery too. And that there's just like a low friction for cooperation, so that if I'm working with somebody, I'm working on their computer, I can, you know, I know what all the key bindings are. I know what all the installed packages are. I know what, you know, everything can do. And then, you know, kind of the third benefit is that you get a kind of a rock solidness. Like it's not buggy, because a lot of people have to use it. And, you know, if you are maintaining your own configuration, you might be willing to tolerate some sort of sharp corner or rough edge. Whereas if everybody's doing it, then everybody's going to be thinking about it, and then they're going to shave that rough corner down. And then the beauty of also having it shared is to, you know, when someone does sand that corner down, so then it becomes really a pleasure to use, then they can share it with everybody and everybody benefits. You know, so then now you have 4 developers being able to benefit from that time savings rather than just one. And if it's a time savings or some, you know, ergonomic feature that can save, you know, seconds or minutes, I mean, that's actually pretty huge. And those things really do, those micro transactions, they add up. You know, they add up for one developer. That's why we use this highly extensible editor. So if they add up for one developer, and then you can multiply that across 10, You know, you're actually talking about, you know, real cost savings and really, really effective ergonomics.
No, yeah. And that brings up a pretty good point. Some of them I didn't even think about, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's part and parcel of kind of the way we develop software. Like we believe very strongly at our company. One of the values we have is in shared solutions. You know, we believe that we're all kind of the tasks that we take on as developers. Some of them are unique, but most of them are the same. And so, if most of them are the same, then we can erect a big, strong, bulletproof structure on which everyone can ride quickly, rather than having everybody kind of trace their own cow path through the jungle.
Yeah. Okay. Sweet. So now, so you guys have a company, Y Config, but what was the starting force, or who started the whole, hey, we should have a config for the company, or how did that evolve?
That was definitely me. No, I shouldn't take credit for that. I mean, we actually started using a fork of Prelude.
A fork of Prelude.
So Prelude is a starter kit.
There's a bunch of Emacs starter kit.
There's a bunch of different Emacs starter kits. SpaceMax wasn't even around at that point. So we started with a fork of Prelude. But the thing is, we were customizing. Everybody had their own kind of customizations of Prelude. But I think it's a testament to this technique of having a shared configuration, whether it's SpaceMax, whether it's Prelude, whether it's Emacs Starter Kit, or whether it's, you know, Doom is one that we've been really looking at a lot lately, which is, I mean, it's ostensibly one person's .emacs, .d directory, but I think there's a lot of contributors and a lot of people who use it. But whether it's any one of those, it's a testament to how effective it is that you can build such an awesome out-of-the-box experience. I mean, if you've ever used Prelude, you know, you basically start out with it, and it downloads probably 30 packages and configures them, and it looks pretty. Like, you know, just without you writing a single line of ELISP, it looks pretty. It's got support for projects. It's got support for fuzzy matching. It's got support for completion. It's got support for, IntelliSense, Code Insight, or whatever you want to call it. It's got nice ergonomics for making sure for managing files. It comes bundled with Magit. It's like, you know, it's got everything. It is something that can, you know, compete on par with the most modern of editors. And so I really, really like that. And I don't think that any one developer would get there on their own, just hacking around without the support of the community, without the ability to share. I mean, the person who did, Doom Emacs package, like, did, but I don't know if they would have after having seen like SpaceMax and Prelude and what those things are capable of. Seeing that value and then but there were definite changes that I wanted to make to Prelude to account for the type of development that we did, that maybe weren't the most important thing to have in Prelude core. And so we forked it and maintained our own copy of it. But those things, those types of development that we did, like, you know, we're heavy into front ends. So we do a lot of JavaScript development, for example. And so we had a lot of customizations to the way, to kind of the Brace Prelude JavaScript config. And so, but I wanted, those were valuable. So I wanted to make sure that we shared those with everybody at the company. And again, if, you know, we've had these enhancements that really make editing JavaScript code a lot better, then why not have every developer be able to benefit from that immediately? And if we make a change, have them be able to benefit from it, not by me telling them about it so that they can add it to their own Emacs config, maybe someday, maybe later, but they can just update the package and away you go.
So the Emacs config, it's hosted on GitHub, right? Do you guys have CI set up with that as well, or?
We do. So our configuration is, I think, a little bit unique in that it's set up on GitHub, and we do have CI but it's not distributed. It's not a Git repository that you check out into your own home directory. It's actually distributed as an elist package archive. And so what you do is, now it probably ought to be the only one or the only thing that in your knit.el. We actually have some strategies which for how you can layer on your own customizations on top of it, which I can get into later. But it, what it does is when we make a change, it actually builds it. If we have a test suite and it runs against the test suite, and if the test suite passes, then it actually pushes it up to our ELPA archive, or I guess I have too many archives in there. It's an ELIS package that it pushes up to the ELIS package archive. And so we actually maintain elpa.frontside.io with our own packages. And so then the advantage of that is there's, you know, kind of really twofold advantages of that. One is that because we distribute it as a package, updating it doesn't involve like pulling in new changes, rebasing them from upstream, then kind of, you know, making sure that your own commits, there's no merge conflicts or anything like that. What happens is instead you just update the FrontMax package and it just, you know, it updates all the packages that it needs to and updates the configurations, you restart Emacs and you're up and running. You don't have to get involved with Git at all.
Oh, that's a pretty smart strategy.
Yeah, no, it's worked out really, really well. It turns out like setting up your own ELPA is a little bit harder than I think it ought to be. But there's some things that we've learned that we might have been able to do it better, but it's still a little bit of a pain. There's not like, it would be nice if it was like NPM or RubyGems or pip or literally it seems like every other package manager, there's no open Emacs package archive. And I don't know if that has to do with security or just culture or whatever, but everything is, you know, kind of Melpa, which is the biggest third party archive, is curated. So you have to really, you know, they've got a gate in front and you have to put forward your case as to why this is a valuable package before they'll actually include it. And I don't know that that's necessarily a bad strategy, but if you want to, you know, we proposed this originally to the maintainers of Melpa, and they kind of said, well, we're not really, you know, we don't maintain shared configurations on Melpa. There's a few, but we've made a commitment not to do it anymore. And while I would have liked for them to have made an exception for me, I definitely understand the desire or the, you know, the impetus not to. So we set about setting up our own, and there were a bunch of different hoops that we had to jump through. But once we got it set up, it's really nice to have your own continuous integration and delivery, and so that you can, you know, just push it up automatically and distribute it to everywhere.
Oh, nice. Sweet. Do you remember any of the major challenges you had in setting up Melpa?
Yeah. I do. So the first was, basically our package archive is automatically deployed to an S3 bucket. But the problem is, you know, we wanted to serve it over SSL, because we wanted to make sure that, you know, it was the packages that you were downloading were at least coming from, you know, elpa.frontside.io. And so I think the hardest part was actually the Emacs, like the package code client. And this is just getting a little bit too into the weeds. What was it doing? We basically had to modify the request that was going out. And so we kind of had to monkey patch a variable inside package.el so that it would properly handle the SSL negotiation, because the SSL client was a little bit Byzantine with inside Emacs. I don't remember the details exactly, so I'll keep it intentionally vague, but getting it to play nice was a little bit of a pain. There was a thing that we had to do. We had to fork cask, which is the Emacs dependency resolution and development tool. Yeah. And that wasn't that was a little bit difficult to figure out. So there were some yaks that needed to be shaved. And so suffice it to say, there was a lot of yak hair on the floor by the time that whole thing got stood up. But now that it's up and running, it's really, really great. And we've got a set of integration tests and unit tests against the package. We don't go so far as to test key bindings, but we do make sure that, for example, when you install the package, that it will download everything off the internet and boot up without errors. So we have kind of a grand integration test. And then for, you know, custom features, we do have unit tests for any of our own functions that we write.
Okay, sweet. So so after having all that set up, you mentioned something about when you download the Emacs configuration, that there was some way that you can make your own changes on top of that, that you set a certain procedure.
Yes.
Could you go a little into detail about that?
Yeah. So when FrontMax is the name of our shared configuration. It's at github.com/thefrontside/frontmax. And so it's installed as a package. And so we just use a very Emacs solution, which is to have hooks. So we have several places that you can hook into in the FrontMax initialization process to add your own custom configurations. So the first thing that it does is it reads this thing that's inside your home directory called config.el. And that's before any FrontMax code actually runs. There's a bunch of configuration variables that you can set. So things like the theme, things like your JavaScript indent or whatever. And then as it's running, it will read those variables and it will configure itself. And then afterwards, there are also, and you can just drop any EL file inside of a directory called initializers, and FrontMax will run all of those initializers after itself has been booted. And so we haven't really found any need to go any more fine-grained than that. There's kind of these two hooks, one to set static configuration variables, and then one to run code based on those initialization variables. So for example, when I do experimental features, I'll just have like a, you know, experimental.el in my initializers directory. And that will just do things like, I was recently playing around with the TypeScript tide mode, which if anybody's ever used it, it's really fantastic. It analyzes your TypeScript code base and you get completion and documentation and refactorings and things like that. And so I was kind of playing around with different key bindings about maybe using it for JavaScript mode instead of JS2 mode. But all that was like experimental, and I didn't really want it to be in the package because it just didn't make sense to do it at that point. So I just dropped it all in an initializer. And so you have kind of free range to do whatever you want in those initializers. And so what you're doing is, instead of layering on, you know, commits, you just the composition between the base configuration and your changes happens just on the file system.
Okay. All right. Sweet. So do you guys do any code reviews with each other? You guys ever find yourself like, oh, what, I was expecting this kind of key binding to do X or Y, but it ended up doing A or something?
No, that's actually one of the advantages of having a shared config is the key bindings are uniform, and you really have to kind of agree on the ergonomics of them and debate them. And, you know, if you're working by yourself, people will just be like, this key binding, whatever, I'll just do it. And there's not a lot of thought that goes into it. And then it becomes burned into your muscle memory. And you know what? It's fine for you. But it might not integrate into other people's key bindings. And so, you know, I think you kind of like replicate the community of Emacs itself by having, you know, these kind of well-worn bindings that everybody understands, just in a very, in a smaller fashion. It's deliberate, it harmonizes with the other things, and, you know, everybody shares those same key bindings. So it would be very weird if I had something different than like control N and control P. We don't, and it's actually great.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't recommend messing with, you know, the core key value.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
Definitely. All right.
So now the important question, how many, did you guys have any BIM users before this? Did you guys were able to convert any?
Yeah. Yeah, actually I can, there's two of note. We had one who was actually one of our clients. And I don't think he uses our shared config, but he definitely saw what we were doing with Emacs. He started running Emacs in evil mode, and then he started running, he was like, nah, you know what? If I'm just going to learn Emacs, I'm just going to learn it. And then, so he turned off evil mode and was really, really, really happy. But I don't know, he might've gone, you know, a lot of people love Space Max. So I don't know about that. And then we currently have one person who is in the process of moving over. And I don't know what he's going to do in terms of his key bindings. If he's going to try and go the evil route or just, you know, go kind of vanilla Emacs or holy mode, as it's called.
Okay. Yeah, that's the way I learned it as well. Just straight, no config. I didn't even know that you packages existed. I was just trying it out, trying to figure out how everything worked.
Did you come over from VI?
No, I was using, you know, the mainstream editors, Eclipse, whatever. I don't even remember the names.
Right.
Whatever mainstream editors. And I remember coding, since the homework assignments were all in Java, I was doing Java by hand in Emacs. I was wondering, where is this completion at that everybody keeps talking about? So yeah, I was struggling for a bit just doing everything manually. Once I figured it out, I was in heaven. So yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
So you've also made some contributions to, what was it, JS Mode 2 or?
Yes. So one of the things that was very frustrating for me, being an Emacs user, and this is, I think, in probably 2014, is when ES6 modules came out. And JS2 mode, so ES6 modules for people who aren't JavaScript coders are basically a way to do static imports in JavaScript. So before, there was kind of only dynamic scope where, you know, you just have kind of these, most of your values were lexically bound, but then you just kind of have these rando variables that are dynamically bound. And ES6 modules let you move away from that by actually importing code from modules. So there are no symbols. There's no symbols that aren't either bound inside of a file or a function or statically imported from a module. And so, but JS2 mode didn't have support for that. And so every time as we started migrating all of our JavaScript code over to using ES6 modules, the syntax highlighter would go nuts, the refactorings didn't work, and, you know, we depend very highly on JavaScript refactoring because it's one of the great things that you get with Emacs. And so I kind of filed an issue on JS2 mode, and nothing happened. And then I kind of realized, okay, well, nobody's going to do this. I guess I'm going to have to do it myself. And so kind of just rolled up my sleeves. I'd never written any ELIS before that, and then just kind of dove into it to try and add support for ES6 modules to JS2 mode. So after signing my GNU contributors agreement, you know, I went to work, and I don't know if the code was the best, but it was well unit tested. And so I was able to, you know, add that support and get it so that you can, you know, you can treat like statically bound variables just like you can any other variables. So both at the syntax level and the refactoring level and all that stuff. So that was good. But that was my contribution. It was my first introduction to ELISP.
Okay. Yeah, sweet. That's pretty awesome. Just start contributing right from the start. That's awesome.
Well, it only took 17 years.
All right. Motivation. All right. So, what since we're talking about JS, what are some of the core packages that you guys use to help you with your everyday JS? And also, are there any specific packages to help you with your specific framework? Because I know like React has like their its own JS mode and stuff like that.
So usually, so the things that we needed to have in our configuration were, you know, one, definitely all the snippets for the modes that we used or for the frameworks that we used. Like you mentioned, you know, React, Ember, Mocha was a big one. And we initially ended up writing a bunch of snippets for Mocha. So, and then, but then, you know, kind of the transformative ones were making sure that we had, you know, JS2 completion and that we had the JS2 refactor mode, which at the end was dependent on like multiple cursors. So JS2 refactor mode is a fantastic mode on which we rely super heavily and have, you know, for the past 3 years. And what that allows you to do is, you know, in JS2 mode is kind of unique in modes, unique in non-Lisp modes, in that there's a full JavaScript parser that comes with JS2 mode. It's written in ELISP, and it parses your file as you're going. It's actually understanding the entire syntax tree of your JavaScript file. And so what that means is then you can, you know, kick off functions that transform that JavaScript file or transform that tree, which is then reflected back in the code that's inside the edit buffer. And so, for example, you can rename a variable. One of my favorite things is you can log out an expression. And so what you can do is, you know, you can say, I want to take this and I want to log out this expression, and it'll generate the log statement, you know, that says this expression equals, and then it'll pop the expression in line so that you can actually see it. It's a fantastic debugging tool. You can, you know, extract functions, you can rename functions, you can inline variables. So if you have, you know, if you have some value and it only appears in two places, and for performance reasons, you want to inline it, you can just, you know, click it and it'll take that value and it'll substitute the right-hand side of the expression everywhere that variable appears. You know, it's all kind of the classic refactorings that you're used to with a thing like IntelliJ or an Eclipse, and it's right there in JavaScript mode. And so we love that. But that was something that wasn't in Prelude. It's something that looked like it wasn't going to get accepted into Prelude. And so, you know, we ended up putting it in.
Nice, sweet, right on.
So there are other things. So other things actually critical is like JSX. If you're developing React code, JSX is broken by default in Emacs, and so you need RJSX mode. And in fact, so which is a extension of JS2 mode. So there's a lot of tools for making a modern. And now we're actually experimenting with TypeScript as well. So there's a lot of tools that are necessary for a modern web development experience that we absolutely needed to have in all of our packages or all of our configurations.
Okay, sweet. I mean, I was trying. I was playing around with React and TypeScript as well, and I mean, I realized that there's a lot of things that go on in the JS world with you guys. So you guys are great for liking that stuff.
Well, hopefully we'll make it easier. You know, hopefully we'll make it easier for everybody else who wants to foray into that realm by saying, here's something that's set up. If you're doing front-end development, if you're doing modern JavaScript development, then, you know, here's a suite of tools that you can use that's basically got your back covered. Other things that we have, just to throw it out there, is we have some tools for parsing node stack traces so that you get compilation. You can parse compilation errors. Like Emacs just doesn't do that out of the box. So things like that too.
Oh, that's pretty sweet. So did you guys build that parser yourself or?
Yeah, just had to do like some rando Emacs regular expressions to parse stack traces. Yeah.
Yeah, whatever gets the work done, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to think. Yeah, other stuff, modifications to your exec path. so that if you're using Node, any installed Node module that you have in the project will be used instead of any global Node modules. But those are hairy implementation details. Just say that, you know, the suffice it to say that there's just a lot of sharp corners that we sanded down.
Okay, sweet, right on. Let's see. Is there any questions that I didn't ask that you felt that would have been great addition?
I'm trying to think if we covered, you talked about the maintaining your own ELPA archive. I think that was, that was definitely a good question. I think I definitely got to answer, but I maybe just can't say it enough again, just how awesome it is to distribute stuff as a package and not actually use Git to maintain, or not use a fork to maintain your installation. So I think having your dot files in Git is a good idea and everyone should do it, but having your dot files be a fork of someone else's dot files is like not scalable because you're constantly doing this pull, rebase, merge, conflict, dance. And being able to sidestep that and avoid it, you know, and be able to keep up to date and making updates be a breeze. Because really that was the problem, was we had the shared configuration, but people were still not keeping up to date. You know, they'd be weeks behind, months behind, because they just didn't want to have to deal with merging. They're like, I've got stuff to do. I just don't want to have to resolve conflicts, but that only makes it get worse. And so then I would have to go around with everybody and help them get upgraded. And that's just not scalable.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Since you guys ran into such a big a moderate sized issue of setting up your own archive, do you guys set up like instructions in case anybody wants to do that, or
I have my notes, because I try to take copious notes of everything that I do. And I mean, I thought about converting this into a blog post, but there's always a lot of content that I need to write and produce. And I mean, I love my Emacs community dearly, but I don't know if y'all are, the best audience for monetizable content. unfortunately for the blogs that I have to do, I have to keep on topic so that people will buy our services. I'd be happy to like post like raw notes of the stuff, of the steps that we had to take.
Okay. Yeah. I'm pretty sure there's always like a small market that's always interested in stuff, you know, done on random, or maybe this is relevant for a portion of people. So
I definitely think there are people who would benefit from it. And so maybe I can post those notes. I'm trying to think like, what would be, maybe just a gist would be an appropriate medium for that. Or, I mean, you can also look at the repository itself.
Okay, sweet. Is there, I cut you like midway, so is there any like other questions that would have been great, or you think good, or?
Man, no, I don't think so.
All right, sweet. So then I guess the final question, and what is your favorite Emacs package?
Oh boy, there are so many, and they are so good, and there's so many great authors out there. I don't know if I can come up with one.
How about?
But I can definitely. Let me. Can I give a couple?
Yeah.
Okay. Go for it. One actually converts into the other. So, or touches on one of the questions that you hit earlier. So I'm going to give two. I'll give two picks. I don't know if they're my favorite, but I think they're great packages. And the authors deserve a lot of credit. And I think that they deserve a lot of credit because they can carry the Emacs community forward in a way that people might not even think was possible. So the first one is kind of one that I just really love and is so effective when kind of demonstrating kind of the power, is the Undo Tree. Have you ever used it before?
Yeah, I used it. Yeah.
So, I mean, you show that to like non-Emacs users and they're like, whoa, mind blown. And so that actually, you know, you show that, and it's a thing where you can actually visualize the entire tree of edits that you ever made since you had a buffer open. And you can navigate anywhere in that tree. And so it's kind of like, instead of a linear undo history, you have a Git-like branching tree structure for your history, which you can navigate in real time with, you know, with your NP, B, and F. And I'm sure you could do the same thing in Vim. Maybe people have come up with these packages. I didn't even know that Emacs tracked that undo information. And so I think it's just such a great package to use. It's a great demo. I mean, there are people I've shown, who see that one package and they're like, okay, that's worth converting for. Nice. And so the fact that, you know, Emacs was like tracking that state internally the whole time, and someone just needed to come and write a visualization for it, I think is pretty amazing. The other one that I really, really like and would recommend for people who are getting into ELISP development is this package called Buttercup, which is a testing package. It's a BDD framework, kind of like Mocha.js or RSpec if you're into Ruby, that for writing unit tests and acceptance tests, but not using the ERT framework, which is extremely bare bones. So it has a great way to, you know, separate the side effects from your assertions. It has a nice, it reads really, really nicely, so you can see what's setup, what's teardown. You can share setup and teardown between test cases really easily by using a nested branching structure. It's just they're really pleasant to write. It's got great matchers for making good error messages. And the output is really, really readable. You can diagnose failed assertions really very quickly. And it also has a really advanced spying and stubbing framework that comes with it. So you can stub functions, stub variables. And so if you're thinking about getting into ELISP development, it's a great way to start and explore and kind of put up guardrails to keep you from, you know, bashing into the walls and knocking your head off, which is so easy to do with ELISP because it's so powerful. And so, you know, for me, those have been two kind of transformative packages. One, the first one that I mentioned is in terms of, you know, showing people the power, how, you know, you can really do incredibly powerful things, but have it feel just breezy.
Yeah.
You know, demonstrating that. So, you know, that's kind of an external pick. And then internally, it's been transformative for me to really be able to get in there and jump into the weeds with ELISP, you know, having a nice, good testing framework at my back. So Undo Tree and Buttercup.
Oh, sweet. I don't think I've heard of Buttercup before, so that's interesting. I will have to check it out. So yeah, whatever helps development.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we'll make it, if you're thinking about doing ELISP development, it makes it about 1/10 as scary.
Okay, sweet. That's good news then.
Yeah. Well, just kidding, yeah, for, you know, that for my style of development, it really just, it, you know, makes it so much easier.
Okay, sweet, right.
All right.
All right. Well, I think we reached the end. So thank you once again, Charles, for being here in the episode.
All right. Thank you, Daniel.
All right. I'll see you later then.
All right. Take it easy.